Okay, Erev Tov, good evening. Firstly, thank big Yasher Koach, a big thank you to Elise Panich, who I would say sort of revived the series, or you know, gave it a new lease of life, which I really appreciate, because we were right in the middle of the alphabet. You know, we're trying to get from A to Z, and we were on L last time. We spoke about the Chaim Leibowitz, and if you didn't hear it or you weren't here, then it's online. All of these shiurim online, YU Torah. So if you have, you know, a minute or two, it's very easy to get access to that particular webpage. What is a bit off-putting is that there are 150,000 shiurim on that webpage. That is essentially enough for about 10 lifetimes. So, you know, it's unbelievable. It really is absolutely unbelievable. But it goes by name of teacher or subject, so, you know, hopefully we'll find it. You're getting way too technical as far as I'm concerned. Amazon to me is somewhere in Brazil. That's about it. I'll stay with that comment. You know, like what do they say? You know, a line used to be something. Well, no, it's all right. There's a lot of expressions today. Menus have changed. All the language of computers, I'm really lost. So we're going to talk about Mashiach, because this is M, and I had a few options. I was going to talk about mitzvot or miracles, but I thought Mashiach would be relatively controversial, so I thought I'd go with that. And it's particularly important because today in the English calendar, I hope some of you realize, that it's a significant day in modern Zionist history, 29th of November. There is actually my favorite street in Yerushalayim, Kaftet November. It's in Baca. It's one of those, it's what they used to call newer areas, not new anymore. And when I saw the street for the first time, I didn't know what Kaftet November, you know, it's strange, 29th November. Turns out that in Queens, New York, which I'm glad to say, you know, hopefully we're all aware where that is, in 1947, on the 29th of November, there was the United Nations vote. And as a consequence of that particular vote, which was touch and go right to the end, and there's a very nice, again, if we're giving web pages, there is, those of you who use YouTube, there is a series of 10-minute films, and it's called Toldot Yisrael, spelled in English, T-O-L-D-O-T, Toldot Yisrael. And if you just search, you'll see there's a very nice 10-minute film about Kaftet November, telling exactly what happened, the famous pictures of the people dancing in the streets. It was a messianic day. It was a day of Mashiach. People used the word Mashiach to the Jews of Europe, particularly those who have come out of the Holocaust. This was, it was so significant, and the people, when they talk about it, and they're talking about it 70 years later, right? There's a beautiful interview there with Yehuda Avner, who passed away not so long ago, and you can see almost the tears in his eyes. You know, 70 years, how it generated that sense of return to Eretz Yisrael is quite extraordinary, and the word Mashiach is used in that film a number of times. They saw it as a messianic moment, and it really is worth seeing. So, you know, I think it's relevant to talk a bit about Mashiach. The story I want to begin with is a famous story, but you may not have come across it. You may have heard it in various forms, and it's about the city of Telz. Telz was Now you've got the Telz Yeshiva in Cleveland, but once upon a time, it used to be in Telz. There was a city in Lithuania. My Rosh Yeshiva in England was a Talmud in the Yeshiva of Telz. He was known as a Telzer. That was what they called him. And there was a young man who was... He'd got away for a few weeks. He probably had some sort of illness, and he had to go home. And in the meantime, while he was away from the Yeshiva, they got a donation of a Sefer Torah, which was very nice. And in those days, as today, they made a big fuss. And the Sefer Torah... Good evening. Hi. Sneaking in there. So the Sefer Torah was duly presented, you know, with pomp and circumstance, the chuppah and the whole works. And in the middle of the celebration, and the tells Shtetl, you can imagine that everybody came out to dance, this young man comes back on the train, he's come home, he's come from home, he's come back to the yeshiva. And he sees the people dancing in the street. And his first reaction, very interesting, this is probably 1920s, his first reaction goes up to one of the guys, one of the yeshiva boys, he says, "Where's Mashiach? You're dancing in the street. There must be, this is it, Mashiach has come." And then he went to another guy, and and the guy started making fun of him. They said, "What do you mean, Mashiach? Don't you know about the Sefer Torah?" And they told him the whole story. And he got back to the Rosh Yeshiva, what happened. And the next day, Rosh Yeshiva gave a talk, Rav Bloch, he gave a talk in the yeshiva. And he said that, I want to tell you something, he said that there's one boy in this yeshiva, only one boy, who has emunah in Mashiach. So they all sat there thinking, oh, it must be me, it must be me. And he said, that young man that came back yesterday, he gets it. He understands that when something is so different, the world takes on a whole new, you know, like you say, you put on different glasses, you see the world differently. That's a messianic time. And this is a famous story and tells that this young man taught the whole yeshiva a lesson in what it means to be ready for Mashiach. And as you'll see on the page in front of you, I start off by saying it's a very central but very obscure topic. The reason why I use the word again, because this followed another sikha which I gave, which I haven't given here, which is about Olam Haba, right, the world to come, which is also incredibly difficult to talk about. There are a number of very sort of difficult statements in the Talmud. People went and came back. And what did they see there? And that's a discussion for another time. The reason why this is so strange is, number one, it's very central to all major religious faiths of the world. Mashiach is in fact, something very interesting. Rambam, Maimonides, was not famous or well known for his pro-Christian comments. Right? You'll see very often when he talks about Christianity, he's very scathing. But one thing he says, I'll give them a benefit of the doubt, I will even praise Christianity. He writes this. And the reason why he praises it is, he says, because they've spread the idea of Mashiach around the world. They've gone into the jungles, they've gone into the who knows where, and everybody will know when Mashiach happens, they'll think it's the second time round. And we're talking about the first time round, whatever it is, but everybody will know what's going on. And Rambam was prepared to write that. He even put it in writing, which I find amazing. That he gave Christianity that kind of, let's say, boost because of what he saw that they had done. They had achieved spreading the messianic concept, right? And again, I think that's worth knowing. What I've written here, and this is extremely important, is that although it's central in our religious belief, and many people every day say the animamins, animamim shalema, we have all the tunes and all the folklore that goes around the animamins. And I have to say, when I last gave this talk, it was mainly to a group of Holocaust survivors, and it was a very emotional talk, because as soon as you start getting into the animamin sort of frame of mind, the people had come out of Auschwitz and places too terrible to think about, and they know how people sort of died with animamin on their lips. The stories came at me sort of from all different directions. I'll never forget it. It was really quite a moving experience just to talk to that group about this particular topic about Mashiach. But saying that, the Rambam gives us a warning, and this is the first Hebrew paragraph on the first page, and I'll just read it to you. He says, "Kol elu dvarim ukiyotze behem lo yeda adam." Ech yiyu, we have no clue what it really means. This is what he's saying. Ach yiyu, until they happen. Wow, thank you. Shadavarim stumim heim. Eitz ha-Nevi'im, this is not even mentioned in the prophets. Gam ha-Chachamim, ein lem Kabbalah, b'davarim eilem. Even the rabbis don't seem to have a fixed tradition. Some say, you know, there's a whole section of Talmud, what's going to be, and there's tremendous disagreements, as we're going to see now as well. He says, Ela lefi hecha psukim. Even with looking at the verses in the Bible, it's not clear. Lefichach yesh le machlokiv devarim eilem. That's why there's a whole argument. And the Rambam is very cautious, although he writes so much about it, he's very cautious to say to you, don't dwell on it too much. It's one of those things, the pasuk, we know this verse very well, Yeshuat Hashem keherifayim. The salvation of God is like the blink of an eye. From one moment to the next, it'll look bad and then it becomes good. And, you know, just thinking on the way here, there's a tradition that the world is going to be 6,000 years, and then it's the messianic period. So we're now 5, 7, 7, 8, so you can do the math. We've got another 200 and odd years to go. It's not that long. So you're talking about the generations of, hopefully, our, you know, people are living longer all the time, so great, maybe a couple of greats thrown in, grandchildren, will experience something which, who knows, it may very well be. This whole discussion is not going to be something very, theoretical. It's going to be practical. And I'm just thinking how they're going to prepare. Would it be like the Y2K fiasco that everybody went through, if you remember, the year 2000, and the whole Meshuggahs, you know, countdown, and of course realizing that in London they'd already hit 2000 before they hit 2000 here, and the world was going to end, and the world was going to begin. I'm not quite sure what it was going to do. And, you know, it's strange. I'm just wondering how that 5999, how that year is going to play out will be very interesting, but I guess we'll have to sort of... you know, sort of maybe we'll come back as a reincarnation to experience it. Who knows? I don't want to get into reincarnation. That's a whole other topic. Listen to this. It's so, so interesting. Just a couple of general comments which are made about the messianic period. Will it be natural or supernatural? Right? As they say, will the grass be green or will the grass be blue? Okay? Will the birds fly sort of, you know, overhead? Or will there be a whole change in nature? In other words, what's going to happen? What is it going to be like in terms of nature, in terms of the world around us? What is the messianic period going to be like? And surprise, surprise, there's a big argument. Here you've got four great rabbis, Rav Sadia Gaon, around the sort of the 10th century Common Era, Abarbanel, who was in Spain, he was exiled with the Spanish Jews, 1492, died in 1508, Ramban, Nachmanides, a bit before that, sort of in the 1200s, they all agreed, these three great rabbis, it's going to be a supernatural event. The world is going to change. Wow. Rambam says, no. Rambam's a rationalist, as I think I've mentioned a number of times. And the Rambam here writes, and I've just, this is the second Hebrew paragraph on the page. He says, Vayala datcha, do not believe, Shamelech HaMashiach tzarich lasot otodom oftim. Does the Messiah have to do wonders and signs? Again, a bit of a dig at Christianity. Because Christianity is certainly... the religion is very much based on the sort of the wondrous events that took place and presumably will take place again. As far as the Rambam is concerned, it's not a question of Mashiach coming along and doing some incredible signs. U'mechadesh devarim ba'olam, or there'll be new things in the world. You know, who knows what will be. O'mechaye meitim, or he's going to bring back the dead. You know, sort of thinking of Fiddle on the Roof and that whole scene with From a Sarah, if you know what I'm talking about. U'kiyotze b'devarim elu. It's not going to be like that. And he's pretty definite about this. So Maimonides obviously had his own strong tradition, even though he tells you not to do too much study of it. He's pretty clear on what he believes. And he goes on, he says, do not believe on your heart. Do not sort of, you know, sort of internalize. Things will change in the time of the Mashiach. It's not going to be true. Oh yes, shum chidush b'maaseh bereshit, or something new in the creation. It's not going to happen. Ela olam k'minhago noheg. So he says the world will carry on the way it is. Okay, the buses will still be late, and the MTA will still be as bad as ever. You know, I'm just talking about my own daily experience that I have. And nothing's going to change from that point of view. But what will change, we'll talk about in a minute. So already you can see that the rabbis are conflicted. What is the messianic period going to be like? I suppose they would all be, you know, so be around today and be wondering, number one, what is going on in the world where, you know, the biggest power in the world is being threatened by this tiny country, which is like, I don't know how many thousands of miles away, and saying that this is a crazy situation, and seeing the world today as a kind of messianic laboratory. Things are happening which are just not to be explained rationally or logically, but they're happening around us. What, again, you know, it's interesting to see how this would all play out according to these particular points of view, but we'll go on. Question, why isn't it in the Torah? Why doesn't the Torah talk about Mashiach? Right, why doesn't it say in the Shema, that Shema Yisrael, and then, you shall love the Lord your God, and believe that there's going to be a Messiah. There's nothing like that in the Bible. It's not even in the Nevi'im, it's very hard to find references. The suggestion is, and this is on the next page, it's a double-sided page, that there are certain elements of Jewish belief which are not in the Torah direct. They are kind of, I don't know how to describe it, I suppose, not that they developed later in Jewish history, they were presumably always there, but they are not in the Torah. The Torah is bricks and mortar. The Torah is about things which we can touch, things that we can experience. What does it say in the Shema? Right, if you love the Lord your God, etc., and there will be rain, and if you don't observe the mitzvot, there won't be rain, and the crops will not grow, and you're going to have famine. And, you know, the Torah is talking in very basic day-to-day experience of the people of the day and beyond. This could be our situation as well. And it's very rare that the Torah sort of certainly the five books of Moshe and even beyond go into these more esoteric sort of difficult areas. It just doesn't feature. One phrase that does feature, it's already in Bereishit, and I noted it on the second page, is Vayikra Yaakov al Banav, Vayomer he'asvu v'agido lachem et asher yikra etchem b'acharit hayamim. This very generic statement, phrase, the use of the term acharit hayamim, at the end of days. And nobody knows exactly what he was referring to. Yaakov was having some sort of prophetic connection to his children at the time. And again, to put the balance, you've got Bilam in chapter 24 of Bamidbar, the next quote there. Ata hineni olech la'ami l'cha yatzcha she'yaseh ha'amazeh la'amcha b'acharit hayamim. Even Bilam knew this concept, acharit hayamim, the end of days. Right, so he refers to it, and there's more references in Devarim. If you want to look these things up, there's Yeshayo, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, you know, all the standard prophets, etc., and Book of Daniel. We're going to talk about the Book of Daniel in a minute. I've got Shiurim. If you want to sort of hear something really off the page, there's, I think we did 12 Shiurim on the Book of Daniel. It's something that nobody learns, and it's a staggering book, staggering. Particularly towards the end, where he does get very messianic. Book of Daniel, again, not sure what he's actually talking about, but it's fascinating. Really, really worth spending some time studying. So that's something I would recommend. So at the moment, we're sort of, you know, scratching around in the dark. We know there's a concept, achrit yamim, whatever that is. We know that we're told not really to dwell on this because it's going to happen. You know, we'll know when it's happening, but we're not really supposed to think about it. Is the world going to be different? Argument between great rabbis. It's already, you can see, everything is at, you know, sixes and sevens, as we say. It's all over the place. Look at this next section of predictions. This is very, very interesting. In 1989, when was Chedva born? 89, right? Because we came to the States. What happened was that I was, we came because of a very nice simcha that we attended. And at the same time, I visited a cousin of mine who lives in Crown Heights. And I had the very unique pleasure of sort of experiencing Lubavitcher Rebbe. He was at the time 87, I think, or 88 years old. He came in, he sort of breezed into the Beit Midrash, the Daven, whatever, Mincha Maariv. And then he sort of ran out. I've never seen a man at 80 years, you know, 88 years old, not walk, he ran. And they're singing. You know, this is Mincha on a Thursday afternoon, and they're already singing and whatever. You could feel the energy. The energy of that man you can still feel it, even though he's been dead for nearly 30 years, 25 years. What was so interesting at that time was the fervor around him in terms of messianic hopes, messianic predictions. It even got to the point in 1991, when after he'd had his stroke and he really was incapacitated, really incapacitated, there was a rumor that went round from Crown Heights, and it even got into the London press. I haven't got the clipping. I've got a clipping from the Jewish newspaper about Messianic Lubavitch, and this is from 1990. Kind of interesting, where there was a lot of criticism about what was going on in Lubavitch at the time. But the reality was, in 1991, there was a real sense that this is it. This is the moment. Just before Rosh Hashanah, a lot of the Hasidim descended on Brooklyn in 91. And they were there Rosh Hashanah time, and there are pictures in all the newspapers, and even in the Times of London, which is to me was remarkable, that they picked up on the story that they're waiting for an announcement, that the Rebbe is going to announce that he is the Mashiach. And at that point, the Rebbe couldn't speak. I mean, it was frustrating, it was sad. And at the same time, I understand what was going on. There was kind of this sense of wanting it to happen, as they say, to predict that it should happen, and hopefully it would happen, yeah.
It used to bother me very much because at gatherings, amazingly big gathering of thousands of followers,
yeah,
they used to say Melech HaMashiach.
Oh, they still do.
Exactly, but he was there.
Oh, yeah.
And he sang with them,
yeah,
believing he's Mashiach.
Yeah, now that's
he himself was there when they were singing.
I know. Had I had a chance to talk to him when I saw him, I would have asked him direct because I was determined to ask him. Do you really think you're Mashiach? And he would have said no. I mean, that's what he would have said.
No, he sang with them.
He never said that, and he never told people to go to Israel.
No,
he told them not to go to Israel.
Right. Well, Lubavitch had a very anti-Zionist history. If you read the early history of the Babish movement, even when the Rebbes came to America, they were pretty anti-Zionist. They've compromised over the years because the Israeli politicians all, was it a photo op or was it a real situation? They always came to see Lubavitcher Rebbe. It was one of their stop-offs, you know, Menachem Begin particularly. He was very close to the Rebbe. He understood that the Rebbe was a great man and he wanted to talk to him. The Rebbe seems to have given some interesting opinions and advice. There's a lot of mysteries about what happened with the Rebbe. Did he encourage this messianic fervor, or could he have stopped it? He never claimed that he stoked the fires, but when you were there and you saw what was going on,
he was not.
And he sang with them. And the other thing, which I still to this day do not understand, Hasidim, the Rebbe is dead, long live the Rebbe. You need a new Rebbe, and they haven't got a new Rebbe. No. And what has happened, I had a friend in London who left Lubavitch. He was a card-carrying Lubavitcher, the whole works. And he left them about 5 years after the Rebbe died because he said, this is not normal what's going on here. Because you've got the messiness on one side and you've got the non-messiness and you've got people in the middle who are not quite sure. It's a balagan. And unfortunately, it hasn't got any better in the last 20 years. What has happened, unbelievably, is that you've got Lubavitch in Crown Heights with its own dynamic, which I don't really want to get into, but you've got Lubavitch around the world, which is phenomenal. You can go to Nepal, India, wherever, but Tibet, and get the biggest Seder in the world. 2,500 people turn up for Seder. Go figure. I can't work that. I really can't understand it. And I see what they're doing on campus, and these are good guys. So I'm conflicted about this. But I want to go back to that 1991, because I want to talk about that. Yes, very quickly.
I was there when he was sick.
Yeah.
And, they would have Rebbe sightings, and the whole town would just converge on Kingston Avenue up.
Yeah.
So I was there for a Shabbat, and on for Kedusha, or when for the Amida, some people thought this was Mizrach.
Yeah.
Some people thought this was
Mizrach. Yeah, I know.
The other Mizrach was where the Rebbe
was. Rebbe was, I know. I have a friend in London who... It's a story I tell. He's lucky to be alive. This was 30 years ago. They were davening Maariv after a Shavuot Brachot or whatever, and his brother-in-law's house, his brother-in-law's card carrying Chabad, had a picture of the Rebbe on the Mizrach wall. And my friend went over and turned it around. And as I said, he's lucky to be alive. I always joke with him. I saw him not long ago. I said, I'm very glad that they didn't kill you on that day, because you did something very dangerous. We joke about it. The getting back to what was going on in the early 90s and the sense of prediction, right? There was this sense that, again, Jews were predicting the messianic moment. And if you see this section in the middle of the second page, the Gemara says it very, very clearly. Amar Rav Shmuel ben Achmani, Amar Rav Yonatan, Tipach Atzman Shemechashvi Kitzin. Let the bones... what's tipach? Be blow up, literally. In other words, let the people die. Those who try and work out the end, the time of Mashiach. The Gemara says what will happen is that if you start predicting Mashiach and he's going to come at 2 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon on the 4th of December, whatever it is, next week, next Tuesday, and he doesn't come, we got a problem. And the problem is that everyone's waiting for him to come, waiting for something to happen, nothing happens, and the situation of emunah, of faith, etc., gets challenged all over again. And predictions have always been a serious problem. There is in the Shiurim on Dani, I use the Malbim a lot. Malbim was a great rabbi. The reason why I like him so much is because, not even ignoring the scholarship of the man, which was par excellence, his life history was so interesting. He had 15 jobs. 15 shtelas. You can imagine a rov going 15 different shuls. And the reason why he went to so many shuls and so many positions, because he couldn't zip his, his opinions were very forthright. You read about what he said, and he was pretty sharp, and he didn't hold back. And at the time, there was a lot of anti-reform sentiment in the sort of, particularly in the Hungarian community, against the new sort of reform movement. And the Malbim led the body against it, and him with the Chatam Sofer and Moshe Sofer and all of them, and he was really a cool guy. I have a feeling that one of the rabbis that I probably would have liked to have met. But put it in very simple terms, when his book came out in the late 1800s on 20 volumes on the Bible, people started boycotting the book, which is great because it means more people will eventually buy it. As soon as you put a book into cherem, everybody goes to buy it. There was a book 12 years ago, it happened the same thing. It's wonderful for the sales, but why were they banning the book? Somebody had read that the Malbim in the book of Daniel in chapter 12 made a prediction about when Mashiach is coming. He predicted, and it's written there, that Mashiach was coming in 1928. Why 1928? You have to read it there. You have to see how it gets to that date. In 1928, and if you look at the history of the Aliyot, in 1928 there was a very big uprising, the Arab uprising in 1927. 27-28. So it's interesting that there was something going on at that particular moment. I can't explain it more than that. And people said, he's predicting Mashiach, the book is awesome. You know, throw it out, don't even buy it. Thank God, in the course of time, people realized that for that one line, you know, even if you ignore the book of Daniel, you've got another 23 books of the Bible that his commentary is phenomenal. And it's become a classic, there's no question about it. What has happened is that with predictions, there is always going to be, like the Gemara says, the problem of the failed prediction. And here I've just written a whole list of names, things that you will have heard of. Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi in the 17th century. It was declaring himself, this was after the Chmielnytskyi massacres in Poland, which one can't even begin to imagine how terrible they were. And he came along and said, I am Mashiach, I'm going to take you out of this terrible situation in Eastern Europe, and we're going to go to Eretz Israel. And the problem was, he was a charlatan. He really was a bad man. He became a Muslim, he converted. And he had other followers. I've got a book at home, I think there have been 15 false messiahs from the days of the beginning of essentially Christianity, which is the first false messiah as far as we're concerned. And Shabtai Tzvi is sort of, you know, towards the end of that list. And this book came out of Bnei Brak, and I think they added Lubavitcher Rebbe as the last chapter of the book, false messiah number 16. I think that's what they wrote there. The book was very controversial, and I'm not happy about that last chapter, but whatever. The interesting thing, again, Rambam was a rationalist. We're going back to Rambam the whole time. There was a story from Marseille in France, 1194. It was about 100 years after the Crusades had started. And the Jews were getting desperate. I'm going through this because I want to get to a point which I think we need to get to here. The Crusades were decimating Jewish community one after the other. We read about it on Tisha B'Av, Mainz and Speyer and all these famous communities. They were being wiped out. And they got desperate. The Jews were desperate for some relief. How are we going to get out of this terrible situation? These heathens are coming and they're killing us. And they wrote to Rambam. And one of the questions they asked Rambam, who was living in a Muslim country a very long way away, at that time I think he was living in Egypt, they said, Rabbi Maimon, we know, we've heard of you, you're a great man. Tell us, can we use astrology to predict the Mashiach? That's what they wanted to ask him. That was their question. Very interesting letter. And he wrote back and said, firstly, astrology, waste of time. He says, astronomy, I approve of. Astrology, don't waste your time. Horoscopes, throw them out. Waste of time. He says, however, what he does give them is a lot of chizuk. It's a beautiful letter. If you have the book by Tversky, he translated all of those very interesting letters from the Rambam. And that letter is a classic. Because what he tells the Jews is to have emunah, to have faith, to continue in the way of their ancestors, in the way of Israel. And it will change. It will get better. Which it took a long time in Europe. I mean, you know, if anything, it got worse. Till a point where they moved out of those particular places. They were thrown out of France, eventually thrown out of England, and they ended up in Eastern Europe, which became the haven for a long time till 1939. The reality of all of this is that when Jews were looking for a way out, starting getting involved in messianism, it became problematic. It's almost as if the beginning of involvement in messianism was, by definition, an admission, number one, we've got a problem, and number two, we're trying to find a solution, and just getting into it was already a bad thing. It created this sense of desperation, followed by predictions. And some rabbis did predict, as they do now. There's a whole school of people, I think, in Israel who are trying to predict the dates at the moment. The reality of it is that predictions are the most dangerous aspect of messianism because, as we said before, it leads to disappointments, it leads to questions of emunah, of faith. as with in Crown Heights, there is this whole group of people who still believe not only that the Rebbe is still alive, but he's somewhere spending his time in a graveyard in Queens somewhere. I mean, it's a really scary bunch of people. And they go there and they spend the night there. There's a strange, I would call it dark side to Chabad. And it's strange. It's strange behavior. It's strange. It's, again, born out of desperation. They thought it was a messianic moment. It could have happened, and it didn't happen, and they became desperate. I don't know what to say. I'm upset about it because, as I said, Chabad do such good things around the world. You can't fault them in terms of what they're doing for Yiddishkeit, for general Jewish life. There's almost nothing to compare to it. It's astonishing. But with this element of messianism, it's a problem. It's a real problem. Have a look here. Just a few sort of points of information, because we're going to. Rambam warns you, don't go too deep into this. I'm not going to go too much, but I want to go through some of this stuff because it's kind of interesting. What are the conditions that bring Mashiach? This is again taken from the Gemara. The generation loses hope. Are we living in a hopeful time or are we losing hope today? I'm not sure what to say. I don't know. With leadership, oh my goodness. I don't know. Who is next to fall in terms of, you know, icons and forget about Hollywood and forget about the TV. I mean, it's just kind of scary. Every single day, someone who you thought was the paragon of news or paragon of virtue, and you find out that the man was a lowlife. It's scary. The generation is totally good or totally evil. That's an interesting concept. Again, if we had more time, we'd go into sort of more explanations, but just sort of ponder on that. It's got to be either good or bad. I'm not sure where we got to, but we're certainly not doing well on the good side. A few sages. That's something which really is frustrating, because everybody today is a Rav, a Gaon, you name it. You add, the more titles the people have, the less, I'm sorry to say, I have confidence in what they're doing. I get very upset about this, that somebody who makes pronouncements, usually coming from a man in Israel who is over 100 years old, with all due respect, the only 100-year-old man that I actually, in the last 30 years, that I really had respect for in Israel was Rav, who we went to see? Rav Scheinberg, who wore the tzitziot. And he'd born and bred in America. He knew who the Yankees were. He grew up with all that. He was a very special man. And I had a feeling that when he would say something, he knew the world around, like Rav Moshe Feinstein knew the world. Rav Moshe Feinstein was a very great man, because not only did he have a great knowledge of Torah, but he had a son-in-law and grandchildren who were doctors. He knew when to ask the questions that he needed to give the Jewish law decisions that he gave. Nowadays, I don't know what to say. Everything seems to be going just more and more extreme. You know, less and less breadth of knowledge. It's kind of scary. It goes on here. This youngsters totally disobey the elders. Oh, I'll leave you to work out that one with your grandchildren. I'm not sure what to say about that. They occasionally listen to what we have to say, but I'm just getting a nod from the back of the room there. Look what it says. Ramam again. Always Ramam. Ein Yisrael, the third page. Nigalin el bitshuva. Right, there's going to be a sense of tshuva. That has happened since 1967. No question about it that there's been a movement back to religious life. Not en masse. The numbers today of assimilation numbers are through the roof. 70% assimilation. But at the same time, we know from our personal experience, individuals who've come back to Jewish life, it's really something which is extraordinary. And before the 60s, it wasn't happening the way it's happening today. And he says, "Gvayti chatarash, sof Yisrael lasot tshuva, b'sof galutan." There's going to be a mass of Jews that are going to come towards tshuva at the end of the galut. So that's something which is happening. So you can see, although not all of these conditions are fulfilled, we're certainly in what the rabbis have called ikvata de Mashiach, the messianic time. Who is the Mashiach going to be? You know, who applies for the job? Now here comes, this is a good one. This is clearly not a job for a Jewish boy. Listen to this. It says, Melech HaMashiach, again, Rambam, this middle of the third page, Atid la'amod lachzir malchut David Yoshna. He's got to be descended from David. All of this, by the way, almost without exception, was you could apply to Lubavitcher Rebbe. He was descended from Maharal of Prague, who claimed descent from Rashi, who claimed descent from King David. So there was this kind of sense that, you know, he could claim to go right back to the Davidic line. That's what I was told. by a good card-carrying Lubavitcher. And I believe it. No, I had no reason to doubt it. I didn't see the family tree. I didn't see the Stammbaum, but I'm assuming he wasn't making it up. He says, look what he's got to do here. Lemem Shalah Rishona. He's got to bring back the original government of Israel. That's something which, you know, we see in Eretz Yisrael, what's going on, how that is encouraging in the sense that we are now autonomous, and this is back to the 29th of November. Ubonei HaMikdash, got to build the temple. That's a tough one, because there's about a million Arabs who want to kill us every time we go near to the Har HaBayit. It's not easy at the moment. Mekabes Nidchei Yisrael brings back those who've gone away from Israel. In other words, brings back the Jews, and that clearly was, and still is, the philosophy of Chabad. And that would be applicable. V'chozrim kol mishpatim biyama, and restores a sense of mishpatim. And this is one of the things Baruch Rebbe was really very good at. He made a campaign with the non-Jewish world, the seven mitzvot of Bnei Noach, the Noachide laws. I think there was a picture of him with one of the presidents, one of his representatives, giving one of the presidents, I think it was one of the Bushes, if I'm not mistaken, a plaque with the seven Noachide laws, encouraging the non-Jewish world to become more aware of this. And this is all very sort of good stuff in terms of what we're reading here. And he says, Makrivin Korbanot, they're going to reinstitute sacrifices. That's something which I'm not sure how that's going to work, but we'll have to wait and see. With all the animal liberation people, I'm not sure how they're going to handle that. But Osin Shmitim Yovlot, certainly Shmita today is a big deal in Israel. And Chol Mitzvah Tamur Batorah, so there's a lot of stuff which already we can see, if it wasn't going to be the Rebbe, and the rule of Mashiach clearly is that a dead Mashiach is not Mashiach. Otherwise, if you go for dead Mashiach, you're into another religion. And that was a big discussion when the Rebbe died. For a long time, they weren't even admitting to use the Zal after the name of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And this was a problem, which I think now is already what I call the normative Lubavitch talk about the Rebbe of blessed memory. At least they admit that that's happened. What we can see over here, the job specification is going to be really tough. Man of the tribe Yehuda, man of Torah, charismatic figure, no question about charisma of the Rebbe, that to me was incredible. I experienced that. A great general will fight the wars of Israel, whatever you call the wars of Israel. He's not going to maybe be in the army. I have to tell you a story. In 1968, Shlomo Goren, chief rabbi of Israel, came to London just after the Six-Day War. And they built, I never heard of this guy until he turned up in my shul. It was 2,000 people turned up to hear him. And he came in his army uniform. And here's a man, and they put up his bio. And the bio was that here's a rabbi of the Israeli army who jumps out of aeroplanes. And I'm saying to myself, he jumps out of aeroplanes? He'd learned to be a paratrooper. That was what he did. And he's standing there, and he speaks very acceptable English. And I have this image of him standing in the shul, 1968, I was in 10th grade. And as far as I was concerned, this was Mashiach. He looked the part. He's wearing an Israeli army uniform. He's got this tremendous beard, hadras ponim. And he's talking Torah, and he's jumping out of aeroplanes, and he's a tzanchan, he's a paratrooper. Wow. You know, I was just overwhelmed by this man. And it wasn't meant to be, but, you know, there's a very good read at the moment if you want to read about his life. In English, there's a book that came out. Fascinating. Goren is clearly one of the really interesting characters of the modern state of Israel. No question in my mind. Sorry?
Very controversial.
Always controversial, but that's what makes him such fun, right? He really was a lot of fun. The nature of the world, I've written over here again at the bottom. I'd give a bit more information. I'm just looking at the time. I just want to get to the last page, because this is where we get a list. Order of events. So this is what we've got to look forward to. Elijah comes to make peace in the world. That's a big job. 90 nations, you know, you have to have diagrams, like you remember what Netanyahu did. Eliyahu Navi, he's got to do it. The War of Magog, Gog and Magog, which nobody can explain. I just remember hearing from the grandson of the great rebellion Lopia, his grandson lived in London, that he said the Second World War, he believed, covered this. That the two major powers fighting in the world, he said, we've had enough war. He hoped that was it. We don't have to go through that again. Mashiach comes, Mashiach arrives, and he's got all the job requirements. That's number three. Number four, the rest of the world comes to the recognition of a Jewish God. Is that going to happen so easily? We'll have to wait and see. I'm not convinced that's so difficult, but I don't know. I'm not sure. Peace and honesty prevail in the world. That's a tough one. No war, no jealousy or robbery or murder in the world. Well, the NYPD will be out of a job, but that's the way it goes. prophecy and spirituality will resume. That's challenging. And Torah will be the purpose of existence, essentially meaning a moral existence, you know, based on biblical values. A lot of people are looking for stuff. A lot of people are looking for stuff. I had a student at Stern. She comes in one day and says to me that she spent 6 months in the Kabbalah Center in New York. And she said, you might know my chavrusa, the girl I studied with, the woman I studied with. Her name's Esther. So I said, Esther, you know, Esther in New York, thank you very much. She said, oh, no, you probably know her by her other name, Madonna. I said, excuse me? She said, she sat with Madonna for 6 months studying together Jewish topics. This woman was clearly looking for something to give some meaning to her life. It was fascinating. The student was kind of very laid back about it. I was kind of, wow, you know, sheesh.
Starstruck.
And I that not. Just the concept of Madonna wanting to find out what Judaism is about is amazing. Has she done anything about it? I don't know. Look at what I said at the end here. As obscure as the matter is, we are told of many details impending Messianic days. People such as the Bavitcher Rebizal filled many of the criteria, and the feelings of Messianism are there as strong as ever. And I really believe that's still around. Not so much now. I think Lubavitch has sort of toned down a little bit on the mainstream, but certainly on the edges, it's still very strong there. To me, it would seem that the message is optimism mixed with caution, and I think that's the way to go. When it happens, we will know. And I'll say something which I've said a number of times, and I cry about this. I actually believe, and this is maybe a bit pie in the sky, that Mashiach is wanting to come for many years. And I always believed that, you know, there are points in Jewish existence where Mashiach turns up. And what does he see? He walks down the road in Me'er Sha'arim. If he's going to come anyway, he's got to come in Me'er Sha'arim, or he's got to come in Geula. That's the Jewish world. And he sees yeshiva boys, and they're screaming at the police, and the police are screaming at them, and they're shooting cannons, water cannons. And if you read the news last week, this has been going on in Israel now for a couple of weeks. And a few years ago, when we were living there, a number of years ago, it was burning bus shelters because of the inappropriate, for some, inappropriate advertising. Not sure what was so inappropriate, but they claim they burned down. I think Mashiach, the concept is that he's waiting. He's waiting for us as a nation to come to the realization that if we stop throwing bricks at each other and stop abusing each other, actually sat down and respected each other. I'm not going to love every opinion that I come across in the Jewish world. That's impossible. But at least to have a dialogue with respect, have a dialogue with a sense of you know, I'm trying to understand you, please try and understand me. We're Jews together. You know, when Hitler knocked on the door, he didn't ask, was I Chabad? He didn't ask, was I Reform? He didn't want to know whether I was Orthodox. He just said, Jew, you're out. And this is a lesson which we haven't learned. As a nation, we just haven't got it yet. And I think Mashiach is there, and he comes, and he turns around, and he's gone. And I think that moment has happened a number of times in recent years, and it upsets me. It really upsets me. And I think this is what I want to just end with, sort of on an upbeat point, is, number one, about how the world will know. We've got internet, no problem today. It will go around the world in literally milliseconds. Everybody will know, so that's not an issue anymore. Once upon a time, the people wondered, come fein the Sharim, how are we going to go on the wings of eagles? Comes along, Elal, solves that problem. You know, now we've got internet, how will everybody know? Dead easy. You know, you'll have it on your watch if you have an Apple Watch. You know, it'll be there. Amazing. But what will be so interesting is this last point. Food for thought, the story of the Chofetz Chaim. Chofetz Chaim was one of those people who lived Mashiach. He lived it. He had a suitcase under his bed. Famous story. Somebody, I actually met a Talmud of the Chofetz Chaim, who was my teacher in London for a few years, told me this is true. He had a suitcase packed, ready for the moment Mashiach comes. He's got his suitcase ready, he's off. He actually had a house built in Petah Tikva. It's a very interesting story. He died in 1933. In 1925, he had a house ready to go to Eretz Yisrael. And at that moment, his wife was still alive, and she got sick, and he couldn't go. And he ended up staying in Poland, and he died in 1933. And he lived Mashiach. It wasn't for him sort of pie in the sky. It wasn't something which, you know, we've spoken about a lot of concepts here. Some are relevant, some seem to be sort of way beyond what anything that's possible at the moment. For him, it was an absolute. It was a reality. My Rebbe in Yeshiva, I'll never forget this, Reb Zeid Cohen, who was again a Talmud of Gedolei Yisrael from before the war. His tradition, he was a Cohen. And his tradition was, and again this was the Chofetz Chaim's tradition, that one of the things you have to do in the temple is what is called Malika. The Shochet doesn't take a knife to kill the birds like they do here. They actually use a thumbnail, which is sharpened. And this man, Reb Zeev, I saw this, he had this thumbnail ready to become one of the Kohanim in the temple to use. And I said, Reb Zeev, you know, with all due respect, and he said, no, this is, you know, if we're going to be a dugmai shid, an example for this, this is what you got to do. And he lived it. This is, again, another man who lived Mashiach. I could go on and talk about so much of what was said by sort of so many rabbis. The stories of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, who was one of the great Rosh Yeshiva, was killed in the war, about his whole book that he wrote, Ikvata de Mashiach, wrote about the period of Messiah. There's no question in my mind that we're clearly living in incredible times. I think I've been saying this for the last 30 years, and it's just getting more crazy by the moment. And there's no question in my mind that a lot of what we're saying here is certainly doable. But in terms of the when it all comes together, it's one of those things that, as they say, you'll just know it. It's just one of the things that you'll know. It's not one of the things that we can really prepare for. We can prepare for it by trying to sort of get on with each other a bit better than we have done in the past. That, I think, is one of the ways we really should be preparing. But in terms of the actual events that we're talking about here, you know, keherifies, like the blink of an eye, it will happen. And I think just going through this, just hearing this and getting hopefully a bit inspired by this is a good thing to take away. It's a thing to take away because tikva, as we sing, the Hatikva, the it wasn't by chance that name was given to the Israeli anthem, because it's the only way that we've survived for 2,000 years, is the messianic ideal. The idea that there is hope, there is something that we can look forward to, there is something that we can, you know, sort of we can sort of gaze in the future, and hopefully something will come about. And that has given us the strength to survive it, and hopefully give us the strength to move forward. Is Israel moving in that direction today? I leave you to make up your mind. You know, when I lived there were no malls. It was kind of, it was Israel. You know, my mother thought we actually went to live in Israel. We were living in tents. 1980, thank God, they had buildings by that time. But my mum was convinced, till she came to visit, that we're actually living a reasonably normal life. There were actually traffic lights. She couldn't believe it. Because her image of Israel was from the 1940s. Her father, my grandfather, raised money for Palestine. And, you know, people were living in tents. That's what they were doing in 1940, but not in 1980. That already changed. It's moving forward. It's becoming a phenomenal place. The economy of Israel is beyond belief. But the reality of it is it becoming messianic? I leave you to make up your mind. I feel there is clearly in the world this sense that the world is looking for something. People are looking for something. The world, we're looking for leadership, we're looking for guidance, something that will make sense of all of the, I have to say it, craziness that is going on around us, be it in America or be it in other parts of the world. I just don't know. Bottom line of all of this, as I said, it's a mixture of optimism with caution. And I'm going to leave it at that. Any questions, any comments? Mashiach is a wonderful thing to talk about. Yes, please.
The 6,000
Gemara talks about 2,000 years of Tohu Vavohu, means there's going to be emptiness in the world till Abraham. He was born in the year 1948. That's interesting. Of the Jewish calendar, 1948. And then you get 2,000 years, what it says, Torah, right? Which Abraham traditionally was the first person to start keeping the laws, as presumed whatever he kept. Then, of course, it goes through to the giving of the Torah. And then you get 2,000 years of the Messianic period, which is essentially from the exile of destruction of the Second Temple. So it's broken down to 2006 periods of essentially six days, a day is like 1,000 years. So they talk about 6 days of creation becomes 6,000 years of the history of the world. So we get to the year 6,000. As I said, we've got 200 and whatever years left to go. Something's going to happen.
And so that's the upper limit. That can happen before then?
Correct. Now, and the rabbis put it, they say, Be'ita Achishana, this famous thing in the book of Isaiah. Be'ita means it'll happen, and whenever the time is, it's going to happen. But Achishana, I can make it happen quicker. If we want to really make it happen, we've got to work at it. We've got to, as I said, interpersonal relationships, to me, is what it's really all about.
And
we're going to have to wait around. Our great-great-grandchildren are going to have to do the job for us. Yes?
So is there not a connection between the idea of the resurrection of the dead and Mashiach?
Yeah, it's one of the stages afterwards, and I don't want to get into it, because do we really know what that means? It's all part of this very vague, but something that we're supposed to believe in, you know, intrinsically, in terms of Jewish faith, of events that will take place, like essentially Mashiach, the world will it change, will it not change? You can see there's an argument about that. And then you'll get to next stages, including Tchiyat Amitim, whatever that means. Okay, and will they come back in their prime, or will they come back in, you know, as the way they died? I don't know what to say.
They'll start another plan.
And that's, again, not in the Torah. It's very vague. But it's one of those things that, you know, again, it's interesting how other religions are sort of grabbed onto some of these. I mean, resurrection in Christianity is a big deal, right? Probably a bigger deal for them than it is for us. We really don't want to think about it too much, but they seem to be obsessed by it a lot more than we are.
And what happens to the rest of the nation?
And again, it says, one of the things that quotes here, which I don't know if we read, is the difference between the world to come and the world today is Shibud Malchiyot. In other words, the nations will function, but there won't be this sense of people ruling over others. Wars will end, there won't be, you know, at the moment there's still 100 wars going on in the world in all different countries.
But they're not going to embrace Judaism.
They will recognize it. They will recognize it. The seven Noahid laws, we hope, will become the creed, because it's the laws of morality. Be a good person. Don't steal. Don't murder. You know, be a mensch. And that's a good message for everybody. And I think a lot of people, even if you're brought up in another religious tradition, you know, it's got to have a it's got to resonate somewhere along the line, because it's a good message. It's a good message. I always think of the young, yeah, to be a Zion mensch. Next week, please God, we're talking about non-Orthodox. We're going to talk a little bit, again, sorry to be controversial, Kiruv, dealing with Orthodox and non-Orthodox movements. It's a lot to say. To be continued. Thank you, everybody. Have a good evening. Thank you very much.